This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Michelle Lanier describes her North Carolina roots as so deep that every branch of her family tree crosses into the state in some way or another. And many of those branches helped build the foundation of this state's civic life. She has relatives who preached at the state's oldest black Episcopal church, worked on Black Wall Street, and established North Carolina's first black high school. And from a young age, Michelle has been on a path to continue this legacy. As a kid, she had an insatiable curiosity for understanding how history and culture shaped the world around her. In fifth grade, she did a monologue on Rosa Parks. In high school, attended weekend workshops about African-American history. And throughout all of this, she was mentored by important leaders in South Carolina's historic Gullah community. In her adult life, she turned that deep curiosity into a profession. She served as curator of multicultural initiatives for the state's historic sites, taught oral history classes at Duke, and now she directs the state's African American Heritage Commission. Michelle Lanier joins me in the studio. Welcome back, Michelle. Good to have you here.
It's so good to be here. Thank you.
Tell us about, you were born actually in upstate New York, but then spent most of your childhood in South Carolina. Tell us about those
early days. That's a secret I don't let out much. My daughter's going to laugh, mostly when she mentions the fact that I was born in upstate New York. I reference an Indigo Girls song, Southland in the Springtime, which says, "When God made me born a Yankee, he was fooling."
Well, you know, I'm from there too. Yes. But I didn't do as well as you. So tell us what happened then.
Well, so my family was there for work. Yeah. I don't have memory of that place. I'd love to visit one day in Corning. So early childhood with family there for work, following my mother to Michigan State University for graduate school. And then ultimately we came on back south. I think I was about 4 years old when we relocated in South Carolina, where the bulk of my maternal line was placed because of my grandfather's career in the Army. He retired at Fort Jackson. Certainly a lot of time was spent between South and North Carolina because my father's people were in Raleigh, so I went back and forth between the two states visiting relatives quite a bit.
Tell us about that community you grew up in. Yes. In South Carolina.
So I call the community, particularly my grandmother and grandfather's home community, as an oasis space. It's on the National Register. It's called Waverly. It is a historic black community. The socioeconomic spectrum is broad, so we saw people who were dentists and doctors and professors and people who were custodians. And we saw Vietnam veterans, and we saw many trailblazers all around us, and they were all African-American. Two HBCUs there, Allen and Benedict, thriving black churches, thriving black businesses. And so I grew up in that space where Fish Fry Fridays were vibrant, where strangers were welcome into the home to celebrate life and to be cared for sometimes, where we would go to St. Luke's Episcopal Church with Grandma, maybe on Christmas Eve for Mass. And it was just a very nurturing environment, and it was an environment that imbued a sense of dignity and self-awareness that the older I get, the more I value.
You called it an oasis, and I went at which I think of as some kind of protection from something, a safe place. Were you aware of that or have that sense growing up, or is that a reflection that you have now?
I definitely was aware growing up. In Columbia, South Carolina, I grew up under a Confederate flag that held a spirit of fear for me outside of that oasis. Definitely, at that time in my life, Civil War memory was definitely related to the Confederacy, and the symbols of the Confederacy were symbols that I was supposed to stay away from. They were signs that I was not safe. And so when we could walk to the state capitol, and we would walk there, and we would look up, and we would think, what in the world does this mean? And I remember going on field trips with teachers who would proudly say South Carolina was the first to secede. And I would think, what does that mean to me, this black girl growing up in South Carolina? And my grandmother was the curative and in the oasis space of her home, and my grandfather, who bought me a roll top desk because he said, you're going to be smart. You're going to write. You're going to do things. And my whole committee, my whole village of family, they were the curative to those inaccuracies that are embedded in this white supremacist environment.
Right, and the diversity, too. I mean, as part of that, you talk about the committee that raised you, that much diversity, which is never part of the dominant narrative about life, African-American life. So, as you said, your grandfather said, you know, you were gonna be smart and do something, and you took that kind of seriously. You're kind of a bookworm as a kid, huh?
I was, and I got that naturally. I remember grandparents' homes, great-grandparents' homes, distant relatives. Always had a library, always had books, books everywhere. I cannot think of a single member of my family, immediate or extended, that did not love books. So that comes down through the generations. I'm like sixth generation college educated Black woman. I had an ancestor go to Oberlin. And so those layers of passion around education, I couldn't do anything but love books. And so, yes, I remember trying to read Shakespeare at 8 and, you know, loving my library card, having, you know, very, you know, close relationships with any librarian in any community I lived in.
But lest we think that you're curled up with a book all the time, you were also interested in theater and dance as well, right?
Yes. I was ravenous for life. My mom had me, you know, in dance, which is what little girls were supposed to do at that time. So I remember being in tap and doing, you know, Mr. Sandman with my little glitter tap shoes. But I loved dance. We would have Christmas Eve was a talent show at my grandmother's house. So the cousins would go into our grandpa's office. He had an alarm business. We would go into his office and we would dress up. My eldest cousin was the director, and we would come out and we'd put 45s on the record player and we would dance. And I loved it. It was one of my favorite things in the world to do was to dance. I had a Fisher-Price record player and I would put my vinyl on and I would move.
Part of that committee that you talked about and that culture that you grew up in, you were connected also with the Gullah community. And maybe you can tell us what that is and how important understanding that was for you growing up.
Yes, the Gullah community is a very sacred community to me for so many reasons. My mother was an educator. She worked for the State Department of Education in South Carolina and was offered an opportunity to be the assistant principal first and then later a principal of a school in Beaufort County. We say Beaufort in South Carolina, Beaufort in North Carolina. And so we moved to Hilton Head. And when we moved there, we already had friends there. There were people like Verda Mae Grosvenor, who is an amazing cultural anthropologist, food anthropologist, who was like an aunt to us, who fed me yellow grits and sat at Grandma Ann's table telling amazing stories of her travels and journeys. She was like this African diaspora gypsy, and she would come into town and we'd know it was going to be a good time. But she was a part of my upbringing. And then there was another person who I will call an elder statesman of Gullah identity. And in describing him, I'll explain what it means to be Gullah. So Emory Campbell, who was the director of a place called the Penn Center on St. Helena Island. And the Penn Center was a school. The Penn School was one of the first schools in the country to educate the formerly enslaved African Americans. And as we think about the coastal lands being occupied or liberated by Union forces, there were all of these African-American communities who were walking into a newfound humanity, newfound access, and schooling was a part of that story. And so over time, that school became a cultural center. And Emory Campbell was an important person in the leadership of that place because he helped to grow this awareness of Gullah identity. Gullah, or Geechee, are people of African descent who were brought by force through the transatlantic slave trade. And they were brought from West and Central Africa, many of them brought through the Caribbean, through a very brutal, what we call seasoning process, or breaking of a person and turning them into a slave. And through that process and through their ancestral knowledge around rice cultivation, around basket making, other food ways, spiritual traditions, language. They created something out of necessity, which was a new culture. So all of these various West and Central African cultures wove together, were knitted together to create a new culture that still exists to this day. There's an amazing corridor that the federal government has established that runs from Pender County, North Carolina, all the way down into northern Florida, 30 miles in from the ocean, that helps us to get a geographic sense of where Gullah culture and heritage exist. And so I was living in the middle of that as a child and very much moved by this almost like a revolution of Gullah pride. People who were told that they spoke backwards or were ignorant or were less than, people who heard the word Geechee as a pejorative, all of a sudden had this awareness that not only were they not backwards, they were resilient and brilliant, and that they were able to hold on to these African retentions was something to be proud of.
We will talk more about the importance of all of that today as I explore these questions with my guest, Michelle Lanier, director of the North Carolina African American Heritage Commission. The conversation continues on The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is The State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. My guest this hour is Michelle Lanier. She's an oral historian and folklorist who directs the North Carolina African American Heritage Commission. And before the break, we were talking about your exploration of and discovery of, for yourself, Geechee and Gullah culture, and the importance, what this told you about human resilience, but the importance of culture, of a shared identity in maintaining or in some cases creating that identity in order to promote and nurture that resilience.
Yes, I have a very clear moment where something kind of rang inside of me. Emory Campbell, again, who was the director of the Penn Center, organized a trip over to Dufusky Island, which wasn't far from where we were, but you had to get there by boat. I remember the day was humid. I remember there were no seams in the air. We all had to wear our boat vests. And we get to the island, and some of the women had organized a Frogmore stew, which some people will recognize as a low country boil, you know, with the shrimp and the crab and the sausage and the corn all in there. And we had red punch, and everyone looked kind of somber. I remember Emory Campbell talking about his experience being a part of a documentary film called Family Across the Sea. And his experience going to West Africa and meeting people who spoke the way he spoke, who made baskets the same way people made baskets in his community, who made food the same way he made food. And I remember looking as a little girl across the water and wondering if someone on the other side of that water was related to me and was looking back at me. And I also remember hearing him talk about land loss and the importance of holding on to culture and traditional burial sites that people couldn't access anymore. And I thought, I don't understand all this. I was nine. But I want to pay attention. And there's something about this that I want to do something about.
Is that the birth of the ethnographer?
I think so.
Yeah,
I think so.
Do you have to be? I mean, it's interesting to think about your journey at this point. I mean, it starts in upstate New York. You're a very young girl. You're in South Carolina, but you're moving around a little bit. Now you're in Hilton Head. To some extent, even if you are passionately driven to study this culture, do you have to approach it as something of an outsider? Does that help?
I think that I talk to my students about this a lot, that there's a concept called it being an insider outsider. Mm-hmm. And I think because for many years I was an only child, I do have a sister who's 13 years younger than I am, but for many years I was an only child. And so that meant that I was always watching. And I had two grandparents who were only children. So there was a culture in my family of it's okay to be alone. It's okay to step back. And so, yes, being a part of something, but then pulling back enough to see it is something that I think is intrinsic to who I am.
Right, and not as an outsider, but as someone who's deeply invested in kind of what this means.
Yes.
You also, at one point, met a mentor who is teaching a Saturday school,
yes.
Right? How old were you when you were taking extra go? This was in high school, right?
Yes, I was 14 years old, and there is a medical doctor who I know to this day named Dr. Bernie Gallman, who felt that it was important for he wanted to reach out to young people in the community, particularly African-American young people, to imbue a sense of pride and a sense of the depths, the ancient depths of African history. And so Dr. Gallman opened up his doctor's office on Saturdays to teach a Saturday school where I learned about ancient African culture. And he even took a group of us to my very first academic conference in Chicago, drove us to a conference called ASCAC, which stands for the Association for the Study of Classical African Civilization.
Did you deliver a paper?
I did not, but
okay.
I was absorbing everything like a sponge.
So how were you imagining yourself then? I mean, did the world of ethnography, was that something you were familiar with? Were you imagining yourself a folklorist?
I knew the word anthropology.
Okay.
I wasn't familiar with folklorist in the way that I am a folklorist. I had heard the word folklore, but didn't have a full sense of what that was. It would take until college before I started to understand that there was a career path, and it had the name folklore.
And that college was Spelman. Tell us about your decision to go there and what drove that decision.
Well, a lot of things seemed to happen when I was 14, because this also happened when I was 14. I was up one Saturday night, bored, watching the Miss HBCU pageant. And it still is broadcast every year, I believe, the Miss Historically Black College and University pageant. And I thought, oh, this looks interesting. And side note, I grew up around people who were involved in pageants, and I may have participated in a couple of pageants.
We've got some photos at a website.
Uh-oh.
No, we don't, actually. But we would if we put them.
Well, and, you know, and that was kind of, I really was a folklorist in that I wanted to see what pageant life was like. I wanted to be a cheerleader, but I also wanted to ride a dirt bike. So there was all of that going on. So, but I was up watching TV and I saw Miss Spelman. And Miss Spelman, two things happened that just riveted me. One was she did a theatrical dance performance to Four Women by Nina Simone. Of course, Nina Simone of North Carolina. At that point, I had not yet heard of Nina Simone. So this is my first time hearing this extraordinary voice. And here is the song, Four Women, about four stereotypes of black women. And she's giving voice to it in such a poetic way. At that point, I was interested in poetry, so I thought the lyrics were amazing. And then here's this woman who's embodying these words in a profound way that's both heartbreaking, but it's also holding up a mirror for what I had seen. Even at that point, as young as 14, I had understood that for some people, I was a stereotype. Then, during the question and answer stage, she used the phrase African diaspora, and it was the first time I'd heard that phrase, and I literally thought, that's the kind of woman I want to be. And so I just started continuing to explore Spelman, and when I visited, it was like a bell went off. I knew I was home.
It was important for you. You made a lot of breakthroughs in terms of developing your own identity and your career path. Tell us about the time at Spelman.
It was, you know, Spelman is a historically black college for women. People say it's a girls' school, and I always correct them. It's a women's college. Mm-hmm. So there's a difference. I was there when Jeanetta Cole was there. Of course, Dr. Cole was the president of Bennett. She's now the director of the Museum for African Art at the Smithsonian. So to be there during the Cole years was quite a treasure. It's a beautiful time, any time to be at Spelman. But to be there and to understand that the mission of that college was to make sure that I understood that I could do anything I could dream of. And there were all of these women around me who said, you are not the exception. You are not the token. You're not the little black unicorn in the woods. There's actually a whole, you know, collective of us all over the world. It taught me that black women are not monolithic, that we come from an extremely diverse set of backgrounds. And while there, I had a chance to explore other places. I went to Scotland. I studied at the University of Edinburgh through my through my student time at Spelman, I also had the opportunity to do an exchange at Wellesley. I also did a program in Panama, in Portobello. And so from that safe place, I could really go anywhere.
And you took that time. Is this when your curiosity about Gullah became somewhat more academic
yes.
and programmatic? Go ahead. Tell us about that.
So I was in the honors program, and we had to create a senior thesis. And I knew that I wanted to do something on Gullah culture. There was a part of me that was still that 9-year-old girl who wanted to do something about what I had heard and seen. And so I started studying the song traditions around funerals or the grieving process when someone dies, and how there were all these songs that were so actually affirming and celebratory and that looked to life on the other side. And I was very intrigued by that. And so I created my foundational work looking at Gullah culture. And I had a professor there in the English department. I was an English major who I just, pestered. I said, I know I want to go to graduate school. I have no idea what it needs to be in because I feel that I'm so interdisciplinary. I have no idea what I need to study in graduate school. And we talked about it quite a bit. And ultimately, she had an aha moment and said, I've heard of this program at UNC Chapel Hill called the Curriculum in Folklore. It's a master's program. This sounds like what you're interested in. And that's how I got interested in applying to UNC.
You used all of the different practices and customs and cultural markers that identify Gullah culture. You chose funeral practices. What was it, do you think, that attracted you to that aspect of the culture?
So my mother died when I was 10 unexpectedly, and the last place where we were together in a space where I felt we were a family was in Gullah community. And there was something about looking back at that space, looking back at that land, and leaning into that community. I had what I call other mothers. It's a phrase from Patricia Hill Collins' work. Helen Green was a Gullah woman who held me in her home as if I was her own. She taught me how to pick blackberries and to scare off snakes by making a lot of noise.
those are two very valuable skills, it seems to me.
In her land, I remember digging up fossils. I remember hearing Gullah language. Mm-hmm. And so I felt very loved and nurtured there. My own family of origin, I felt very loved and nurtured there. But there was something about the way Gullah folks dealt with death mm-hmm. that was calling me. I found out later during the field work that it was really almost calling me as a sacred way for me to deal with my own sense of loss. And so there was a balancing act for me because on one hand, I realized it was so personal, so sacred, and indeed so painful. But at the same time, as a folklorist, I wanted to bear witness to the richness of the culture. And so finding out how do I balance those two was really the hard work.
Well, then it seems to me that around funeral practices, you have the essence of kind of where cultural identity and hanging on to culture can be important when it teaches us resilience, when it allows us to change and gives us the space maybe in the growth to deal with change versus a culture that tries to cling to a past that cannot be restored. That's a kind of cultural identity that can be, it seems to me, reckless and dangerous. And we've seen examples of that, too.
Yes. I would say I see a lot of evidence of what I call a dynamic or living culture. There's a wonderful folklorist named Barry Tolkien who talks about the dynamics of folklore, that when we're trying to look at culture that's stuck in amber, that's actually not what we're looking for. We want to look for something that's living and changing. So I'll give you an example. If you go to a Gullah burial ground and you somehow have a time machine and you go back to 1930, you may see on that gravesite the person's glasses, the deceased's glasses, maybe a bottle, an empty bottle of medicine if they took a certain kind of medicine, maybe their favorite thing to drink, or even a stuffed animal. And there are still today Gullah communities where you see the placement of personal items on the grave. But what I found is because of the whole industry, the whole burial industry, you now see people taking styrofoam flowers, mm-hmm. and but they're placing them on the grave in a very similar way. So here are these new technologies, right. these new products that are part of the mourning tradition of today, but people are using them in a traditional way because life right. changes.
And you talk about the importance, the travels that you did in your as a student, Ghana, and you talked about Portobello, Panama. These are places along the African diaspora, beginning in Ghana and then moving into Latin America, South America, of course, North America. What did you learn? How did that change, or did it? How did that inform the work you did today? Ghana,
well, Panama. Yes, and I will say this. I am now even including Edinburgh, Scotland, mm-hmm. as a part of that story, because if we look at the earliest Black physicians in our country, they were able to be educated in Edinburgh before many of the schools here mm-hmm. would educate. So there's this tradition of Black intellectual achievement that's rooted to Edinburgh that I didn't know about until recently.
You're telling me now for the first time. So thank you for that.
So yes, the Atlantic world and the African diaspora certainly has impacted my understanding of even Blackness in the Carolinas. Going to Ghana was powerful in so many reasons, for so many reasons. I remember landing in Accra, and it was at night, and there was traffic. And there were, you know, car horns, and there were taxis. And then the next day, I remember going to, you know, a commercial hub, and there were people using ATM machines. And then we took a tour of the University of Ghana, Legon, that had this exquisite Eastern architecture. And so for me, going to Ghana particularly was important because it disrupted this notion of the singular image of what an African landscape looked like. That, oh, yes, there are people in traditional attire. Yes, there are rural areas. Yes, there are still mud huts in some communities, but there are also mansions and universities and, again, taxis and ATM machines and people on cell phones and people who have access to music sometimes before we do because of Ghana's connection to London and New mm-hmm. York. So that was definitely a very important awakening for me. I also saw in people my father's eyes and faces of relatives and thought, just like I did as a 9-year-old, are you related to me? I had a chance to go to two dungeons where captured Africans were held before being forced into the holds of ships before crossing the Atlantic with the Middle Passage. And I had heard from friends that it would be very emotional to go to those spaces where the soil on the ground still has the aroma of humanity, a humanity that very likely could be in my DNA, and to see the door of no return, meaning once you go through there, you don't come back. And I felt physically weak. I felt nauseous. I felt rage and sadness, but I also felt this sense of jubilation that I am the survivor of all of that. I am the descendant of those who survived that. And though there is a door of no return, I had returned.
And return to study it, to promote it, and to make sure that the rest of us know more about it than we might otherwise. And you take an approach that you call, or perhaps you've, if not coined it, borrowed it from others, spirit-centered ethnography. Did you coin that? Where did
I
that
am.
Come
that's
from?
My. That's mine.
You coined that, but tell us about that phrase and what it means to have to approach folklore and culture with a spirit-centered ethnography.
So spirit-centered ethnography is the methodology that I created for my thesis to graduate with my master's. And I did it out of necessity. I realized that the work that I was doing in Gullah community was so personal and, in fact, very spiritual for me that I felt, You know, you hear people say that they're called to do something, usually associated with a minister. When did they receive their calling? I felt called to do this work, this folkloric work. And so I needed to be, at least for myself, really honest about that and really transparent. And here I was in the context of a community that actually really valued and honored the notion that someone was spiritually invested in the inquiry. There's a kind of connection that one gets when it's one human spirit connecting to another. And so what that also means is that it requires of me that I see the exchange of sharing. Someone giving me access to their human experience, their story, is sacred. And so that humbles me to be a lot more open to bear witness, not just watch, not just observe, but to be a witness, and that it is a part of my calling. It's one of the reasons I am on this earth, is to bear witness to the stories and the culture of others.
We will hear more about that when my conversation with Michelle Lanier continues. She's the director of the North Carolina African American Heritage Commission, also teaches oral history classes at Duke Center for Documentary Studies. Stay with us. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. My guest today is Michelle Lanier. She's director of the North Carolina African American Heritage Commission, where she works to preserve, promote, and protect the state's African American history, arts, and culture. We talked in the introduction about you having roots so deep that every branch of the family tree is somewhere in North Carolina. Tell us about that, the number of people who have been an important part of civic life here in the state.
Yes, I definitely stand on some amazing shoulders in terms of my ancestry. Both sides of my family come from North Carolina. My mother was born at Fort Bragg. My father's people come from Raleigh, and an interesting story about my father's people that connects us to Stagville, historic Stagville, is that there's a WPA slave narrative by a man named Doc Edwards, but he says in the narrative, "I was known as a McCullers." And the McCullers are my father's people from a township called McCullers in Wake County. And my understanding is the first McCullers in our family tree was an enslaved person, a man who was brought back from Mississippi as a wedding present. His name was changed from Boylan to McCullers. And so that is the connection to Stagville for us. And so historic Stagville is really important. On my father's side, we also had this larger-than-life figure who I think a lot of people in Raleigh know of a certain generation, and his name was J.W. Juergen. I called him Papa. He was my great-grandfather. He went by J.W. because he said, no white man will call me by my first name. He was a foundryman. His grandfather was born a slave and was a skilled artisan, was a metal worker. He was born in Franklin County. And with the Reconstruction period, his family moved to different parts of the state. When North Carolina Mutual Life Insurance was born, for a time they lived in Durham, and he sold life insurance for North Carolina Mutual Life Insurance. He eventually settled in Raleigh, became a leader in the historically black First Baptist Church, was head of the Sunday school. He was a part of a group called the Negro Citizens Committee in Raleigh. And J.W. Juergen and others helped to get Chavis Heights and Chavis Park named for the black Rev War hero, John Chavis. He also, my great-grandfather, helped to establish Washington High School and marched on Washington. He had children that went to Shaw University. He was what they call a race man. He wanted to see the uplift of African Americans. So I definitely am walking in his footsteps.
And as is your daughter, it seems, maybe not walking in your footsteps, but she's been a powerful force, your daughter Eden, in your life. While you were getting your graduate degree, you became a mother. Tell us about your relationship with Eden.
Eden is an inspiration to me. I talk about my grandmother being an inspiration, but my daughter's an inspiration. Eden, her name means the delight of God, so she has a lot to live up to. But she, I can't think of a time she didn't have a book in her hand. I was working at UNC Press when I was pregnant with Eden, and so they gave me a baby shower that was all about books. And so she had books from the moment she was born, and she walked early, asked me about politics early, she's written almost all the presidents that have been in office since she's been alive. She's written letters to get historic markers erected for Pauli Murray and Anna Julia Cooper. She's a member of the John Hope Franklin Young Scholars, so published.
She was on this radio show.
She was.
As such, yes.
She was, and she comes from a long line. I know I mentioned my papa, but there were a long line of women in my family that she inherits the legacy of leadership. I think of Grace Lanier Thompson, who taught at Hillside and started an engineer club at Hillside High, and that is what recruited Irwin Holmes to become the first African-American to go to NC State and get his degree there. I think about my cousin Patricia Murray, who attended Bennett College for Women and participated in the Greensboro sit-ins. So all of that is in Eden's blood.
So when she walks up to you and with all of her curiosity and intellectual ferment and says, Mom, I want to read Gone with the Wind,
yes.
You say.
So Eden wanted to read Gone with the Wind. I want to say she was about 11. And I said, no, there are just too many issues of race and gender in that book. I think that you're not ready for that. I'm really concerned. And she would not relent. And so I said, okay, thinking she would back down, I said, if you read Gone with the Wind, I will require that you also read Roots. Well, if anybody has seen these books, they're both huge. Mm-hmm. She read both of them, again, at about 11, back to back.
So there, be careful what you wish for. Yeah, no, I just, any book that's heavy, I just ask somebody else to summarize it for me.
And that, you know, that sense of determination, again, she gets that naturally, too. I think about my maternal grandfather, Gus Caution, the drill sergeant, who they call Bunky. He got kicked out of a school in Pennsylvania because he refused to take down the image of a lynching victim from a bulletin board and was then sent down to Palmer Memorial Institute in Sedalia, North Carolina, where he had had two aunts to attend. He didn't finish there because he blew up something in the boiler room, tinkering with trying to get the heat going. So then he went on to Mary Potter, which is a black boarding school in Oxford, North Carolina.
This is the guy they called Bunky.
Bunky.
Yeah. Well, listen, let me take your career now forward a little bit. You started working for the state in 2006 as curator of multicultural initiatives for the state's historic sites. Tell us about that position, but also what you uncovered about the state as you traveled around.
Wow, that was an education that I so value. When I came into the role of curator, the position had been held by someone, but the person who held it was also managing a site, a historic site. And so that was her focus. And so the work of being a curator of multicultural initiatives had not really been set out for me. So I went about asking people across the state, across our department, even across the region, what can I do with this? And what does this mean? So I'm thinking about historic preservation. I'm thinking about military history. I'm thinking about the history of slavery and how do we tell it in a way that is clear and authentic and inclusive. And so I had so many questions. And so visiting the 27 historic sites, wow, what an education. I'm going to Town Creek Indian Mound and seeing this culture represented, this Mississippian culture, pre-Columbian culture mm-hmm. represented there. And then going to the Charlotte Hawkins Brown Museum in Sedalia and being almost reintroduced to my own family story. Going to the Spencer Shops to learn about the transportation history of North Carolina and how there were these black men who helped to lay the tracks of North Carolina, often singing songs to keep rhythm so that they could be both safe and motivated to work. The black legislators that served in the state capitol, I had no idea of these stories. Harriet Jacobs, who hid in an attic for nearly 7 years and then wrote about it and then came back south to create schools for former slaves. These were stories I didn't have access to until I started to do the work. So my passion became, how do I tell others? And how can I support others in telling the stories?
Then you helped establish the state's African American Heritage Commission,
yes.
where you now work. Talk about the initiative. Well, talk about that, how that came about, and some of the initiatives you're involved in now.
So one of the things that became clear pretty early on is that other states in the South had some sort of statewide entity that acted as a steward or, you know, a champion for the rich African-American history of their state. And I realized we had had something that a man named Dr. Benjamin Speller had created many years ago, which was about historic preservation of buildings primarily. But with Hurricane Floyd, there had to be a shifting of resources away from that for a time. And so I, with his blessing, I said, how can we take that idea and look at what other states are doing around the country and create something that's definitely about the built environment, but about our arts and, you know, our history and our culture. And he gave me the blessing. And with colleagues from the department, we were able to get a general statute passed that allowed for us to create the African American Heritage Commission. One of the things that's really important to me about what we do is we do preserve and promote and protect North Carolina's African American history, arts, and culture. We do it for all people. Mm-hmm. All people have been impacted by, all people of all backgrounds have been impacted by African-American heritage in our state.
Well, tell us about the African-American Music Trails Project.
Yes, that's a project that just keeps growing and growing and growing. It's in 8 counties in eastern North Carolina, and we certainly feel the tug and the pull to expand it to the rest of the state, because when you talk about black music, you have to talk about North Carolina, because we have people like Nina Simone and Roberta Flack and Shirley Caesar and Shirlette Ammons, who I know was on with you all on Friday. So Shirlette Ammons is actually a part of the African American Music Trail of the East because of where she grew up in Mount Olive. We are looking at a multi-genre tradition. So from gospel to funk and everything in between, the eastern part of our state has just been fertile ground for people like Maceo Parker, who's going to receive a Heritage Award on May 25th. And we know he played with Prince because, you know, Prince knew this man is one of the architects of funk.
Well, and to your point, too, that if you talk about music in America, then you have to talk about African-American music in North Carolina.
You have
and
to.
So that's why all of this plays together, and it's all of our history.
Yes.
In some ways, but parts that have been lost and need to be resurrected and preserved, and also the Freedom Road, which is another amazing project.
Yes.
Tell us about that.
So Freedom Road is a project that's been quietly in the works to really tell the story of freedom seeking, and I'll explain what that is. People will know the phrase Underground Railroad, but freedom seeking is something even more expansive than the Underground Railroad. And what it means is people who were enslaved African Americans, who were seeking freedom, whether they got to the North or not. Some of these people were hiding in the Dismal Swamp. Some of these people, like Harriet Jacobs, were hiding in an attic. Some of these people tried to flee, like a woman we called Ma Becky from Somerset Place, but could not and was put in stocks and due to frostbite lost her feet. So the stories of resistance to enslavement and a seeking of liberation, we actually have a rich constellation of stories across the state. According to the federal government, we have the most federally recognized freedom-seeking sites of any state in the Southeast. And we're in the southeastern region of the Department of the Interior. We have the second district in the country, historic Halifax, where you had free blacks, you had literate and skilled artisans who were enslaved, and you had a river. And you had white Quakers who were abolitionists, and that created a perfect storm for freedom-seeking. The only other district that I know of is in Indiana, and it's named for a family called the Coffin family, as in Levi Coffin, who is from Guilford County.
Yeah,
so North Quaker. Carolina, exactly. Yeah. So North Carolina has a powerful freedom-seeking story to tell.
And so this road then would, again, be a kind of a trails across North Carolina,
yes.
And you could reach these points and put these together. You also served as a member of the Civil War 150th Anniversary Committee, and that was revealing, and I think in a lot of ways for you, another milestone for you. Tell us about it.
It was a milestone. I remember when I started to work for State Historic Sites in 2006, and somehow in conversation with colleagues, the notion that, oh, yes, the sesquicentennial is coming, that big word, you know, the 150th anniversary of the American Civil War is coming. And I'm thinking, okay. So I grew up in a space in Columbia, South Carolina, where Civil War memory equaled Confederate memory, and Confederate memory equaled white supremacy. And that meant I was not welcome at the table of memory. That's how I felt. And so there was a certain amount of fear that I had about engaging Civil War memory. And I thought, in this role that I have professionally, if I can't find my seat at that table, I will not be effective in translating to others how integral African-American history is to this story. And I need to be a bridge person to bring people who didn't feel comfortable like me. And so I started ravenously looking for connections. And the first point was when I learned about Princeville, the oldest incorporated black town in the country, when I learned that enslaved African-Americans went and camped out and created a shanty town at a place they called Freedom Hill, and then settled that as a town that they incorporated 20 years later, I thought, how powerful of a story that is. Then I learned that Pauli Murray, the great trailblazer and human rights champion, that she wrote about her grandfather and his role in the American Civil War and how that was such a point of pride. And that's why she was able to stand in proud shoes. Then I learned about Harriet Jacobs, who I mentioned before, as well as Anna Julia Cooper, who was born a slave in Raleigh, but then went on to the Sorbonne and got a doctorate, that she could think back on the Civil War as a scholar, and the 6,000 U.S. color troops from North Carolina.
You know, when you talk about spirit-centered ethnography, I think it gets to something that you have pointed out in your writing that spirit-centered ethnography is not, and that is somehow a way in which you can preserve your own prejudices, that you break through, that it doesn't mean that you stick with whatever it is you came to the study with, but you're always willing to grow and open your mind to new possibilities.
Absolutely. So for me to go to Fort Fisher and to meet with, you know, colleagues who could dress out in Confederate attire and to have a conversation about a man named David Walker, who was really the Malcolm X of the 1800s, and to realize, oh, we can have this conversation.
I've only got about 30 seconds left, but I want to talk about the monument to commemorate the achievements of African Americans. That's going through hearings right now. Where are we on that?
Yes, tomorrow's the last public hearing. It's really important that people come out tomorrow at 6:30 p.m. at the State Capitol, 1 East Edenton Street, to be heard around the development of a monument toward the contributions of African Americans in our state.
We'll post all that information on our website, stateofthings.org. Michelle Lanier, what a pleasure. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thanks for having me, Frank.
Michelle Lanier is the director of the North Carolina African American Heritage Commission. You can find out more about her and her work at our website, stateofthings.org. Final hearing to solicit feedback on a monument to African Americans in our state at the State Capitol grounds happens tomorrow, 6:30, State Capitol Building in Raleigh. Again, details, stateofthings.org. Program produced by Laura Lee, Anita Rao, Will Michaels, and Charlie Shelton Orman. Robin Copley is our technical director, Brent Wolf, WNC's news director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.